I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. It's time for our weekly visit to the barbershop, where the guys talk about what's in the news and what's on their minds. Sitting in the chairs for a shape-up this week are freelance writer Jimmy Israel, civil rights attorney Arsalan Iftikhar, syndicated columnist Ruben Navarrete, and NPR's political editor, our political junkie Ken Rudin. Take it away, Jimmy.
Thanks, Michelle. Hey, fellas, what's good? Welcome to the shop. How we doing?
Hey, hey, hey.
Some week this week.
Well, yeah, tell me about it. Well, there's change coming to Washington, and apparently it arrived in a truck. Senator-elect Scott Brown of Massachusetts takes over the seat held by the late Ted Kennedy for nearly 47 years, Michelle.
Yeah,
seriously.
Sure. There was a special election, of course, as people remember. Scott Brown, the Republican, defeated Democrat Martha Coakley, who was the only woman elected statewide in Massachusetts, if that's of interest to folks. And like you said, the election was to fill the seat of Senator Edward Kennedy. He died in August. And then Brown has become kind of a rock star for the GOP. He's handsome.
Dun-dun.
He's, you know, he's handsome. Did I mention he's handsome? Here's a clip of his victory speech on Tuesday night.
I go to Washington as the representative of no faction or no special interest, answering only to my conscience and to you, the people. However, I know I have a lot to learn in the Senate, but I know who I am and I know who I serve. I'm Scott Brown. I'm from Wrentham. And I drive a truck.
Wow. Good for you, bro. Thanks for that, Michelle.
That's a resume for you.
Right, exactly. Ruben.
Yo.
You're live from Mars. First up, what's up with the Trek reference? And second, is Scott Brown the new face of the GOP? What's up with that?
Yeah, you know, if the GOP is lucky, Scott Brown will be sort of the new face of the GOP because the GOP could use some new faces. And a lot of what Brown is talking about isn't just a criticism of Democrats. It's a criticism of establishment, professional politician Republicans. And so if you could sub out, you know, Scott Brown for some of the, you know, older but not necessarily wiser Republicans in the Senate, you'd be in good shape. On the truck reference, it wasn't just a question of, like, you know, him playing this up out of nowhere. He had a commercial that ran in Massachusetts. Says, you know, he gets in the truck, he drives all over Massachusetts, he finds out what's up, people start telling him about the bad economy, and they voice his concerns and stuff. At the end of the day, he comes home, and, you know, they welcome back, hi, Daddy. So Obama, I think, in his colossal blunder, when he went to campaign for Martha Coakley the weekend before the election, he tried to make fun of the truck, and he tried to say, the president said, well, basically anyone can buy a truck. You know, this is a prop to deploy. Brown comes back and says, actually, Mr. President, in your economy, not everybody can afford to buy a truck. So
wow.
He turned it into an asset. Here's the significance about the truck. When I was growing up, the GOP was thought of as the party of rich folks. But in that election, the voters chose the guy in the truck over the guy who made $4 million in book royalties before even becoming president. So somewhere the world got turned upside down.
Ken.
Wow.
Ruben, how much did your book make?
I'm
just curious.
$4.
We're not hating, but.
That's the real tragedy. Let's not lose sight of that. Okay?
I know. Okay.
I think every copy of Ruben's book is in his truck.
Right, yeah, you've been covering this. Ken, you've been covering this whole thing that's going on in Beantown. What does Scott Brown's victory mean for Massachusetts Governor Deval Patrick, who is Democrat and black? And up for re-election in November.
Well, the whole Democratic Party is you know, after Tuesday's election, Democrats, the White House, President Obama said, we got a wake-up call. If they needed until January 19th for a wake-up call, they could be still sleeping in November. We saw last summer with the anti-tax, the anger coming out of the town hall meetings, the Tea Party activists, all that stuff, the losses in New Jersey, the losses in Virginia, and now in Massachusetts. Whether it's a referendum on President Obama, which I don't think it is, whether it's a referendum on health care, I don't think it is, but there's an anger, there's an uncertainty out there. And if you're going to mock, as Ruben points out, if you're going to mock the trucks, the blue-collar image. Look. The reason Scott Brown ran as an everyman is because the Republican Party had no choice. There was no way they were going to win this seat. They haven't won a Senate seat in Massachusetts since 1972. They have, you know, one out of five people in Massachusetts is a Republican, and very few of them would admit that. But the fact
is, the two Republican governors, William Weld, Mitt Romney, who incidentally was the architect of the health care reform in Massachusetts, which the rest of the country is now trying to get. Well, some people in the country are now trying to get. So
that's true. So and out of 40 state senators in the Massachusetts State Senate, there are five Republicans. The point is, I think sometimes Massachusetts will vote for a Republican governor because they're so sick of one party rule. And that's what the case is. You know, I mean, after Dukakis, you did get a bunch of Republican governors. But for senators, it was Ed Brooke in 72 was the last time. So I don't know if this is a long-term thing. I don't know if Scott Brown has a long-term future for a national voice. He's pro-choice. If you remember, the Republican Party is not known to like pro-choice candidates. Try going to a Republican convention, running for president as a pro-choice candidate. Forget about it.
Right.
But for now, the Democratic Party is taking a hit. And if they still need wake-up calls like this, they're in bigger trouble than we thought.
The president, there's obviously in the wake of a defeat, the finger pointing it's like the chorus of finger pointing. Some people say Martha Coakley, bad candidate. There's some evidence of that. I mean, kind of made a mistake after the primary, coasted in the primary, then took a break.
Slept in
not
December,
a great, right. not a great, not a lot of charisma, you know, and then there's that piece. But then the president had an explanation too. The president talked to ABC's George Stephanopoulos, had a sit-down interview with him right after this. And this is kind of his explanation of what he thinks is going on. Here it is.
One thing that I regret this year is that we were so busy just getting stuff done and dealing with the immediate crises that were in front of us that I think we lost some of that sense of you know, speaking directly to the American people about what their core values are and why we have to make sure those institutions are matching up with those values. And that, I do think, is a mistake of mine.
There's some interesting body language in this. Yes. Ken is shaking his head. I'm not quite sure why. Arsalan, where are you on this?
Well, you know, for me, I want to sort of look at the greater picture here. Just a quick hit on the truck reference. I think that he was sort of trying to, you know, pander to the Sarah Palin, you know, Joe Sixpack constituency there. I think that what's important now is that obviously since the Democrats do not have their 60 votes in the Senate, you know, how are they going to, you know, pass legislation? And so a lot of people
The relevance of the 60 votes is because obviously 50 is a majority,
right.
is...
It's a filibuster-proof majority. And so now what the Democrats will have to use if they want to get their health care bill passed is the reconciliation aspect of parliamentary procedure, which allows for 51 votes because Senate rules call for 20 hours of debate on a topic. The problem is the Democratic Party seems not to have a spine right now. We need to, you know, if they have some legislative cojones now.
Right now.
You know, listen, well, that's the thing. You know, looking at the last, you know.
Waking up.
You know, when the Republicans had the majority, 55-45 during the Bush years, you know, they rammed USAP. Patriot down our throat. They rammed the Military Commissions Act down our throat.
Right.
You know, essentially, Harry Reid needs to, you know, grow a legislative spine and essentially say, listen, there are millions and millions of Americans who voted for the Democratic majority in the Senate, and we need to start pushing our agendas through.
I want to hear from Ken, because this is one of the interesting things that's happened in the wake of this defeat is that many people on the left have been saying, this is the problem. You ran away from your base, and this is why this happened. I don't know, Ken, what do you say? But you're going like...
Well, yeah, I'm just listening to the president with Stephanopoulos saying that we were so busy doing the people's work, we didn't pay attention to what was happening. First of all, if they weren't so busy trying to buy off the Joe Lieberman's, the Ben Nelson's, the Mary Landrews of the world, or at least... let them stymie the whole process. Now they're saying, oh, my God, we only have 59 seats. First of all, 59 seats is
a godsend. Exactly.
I mean, Bush only had 53, 54. And so they could, if they realized what they had a 60 vote, why couldn't they pass it then? Why do they have to wait for a wake-up call like Scott Brown saying, oh, God, well, we're really serious about health care?
Can I ask Ruben, what do you think about that?
Well, Ken's right. I mean, way back when, the way you get out of the vice grip of a Ben Nelson or Mary Landrieu is to make deals with people like Olympia Snow. If you reach out to Republicans, moderate Republicans, now they're going to end up in the crosshairs of their own party, but if she's willing to go there in exchange for, say, getting rid of the public option, you bring her to the table, you're going to get rid of the public option anyway. And what you do there is you lessen the significance of the stranglehold that Ben Nelson has on you. But they played it wrong. They went and made deals with their own folks. It was their own folks who held them up at gunpoint and said, I want this for my state. And then they end up with no Republican support. But this notion, the president doesn't get it. He keeps talking about how we work so hard. The American people are saying, you're doing too much, too fast, spending too much money. You're becoming too detached. You guys are right about dissing the base, moving away from the left on terror policies, on the public option, governing like a Republican in some respects. not focusing enough on jobs, breaking too many promises. Have they closed Gitmo yet? I don't think so. So there's a lot of stuff he's doing wrong, and he doesn't know how to own it. He doesn't know how to stand up and say, I messed up. He's basically saying, I've been working so hard for you folks that I lost sight of this other thing. Instead of, I was wrong, I made mistakes.
I sure hope Ruben will tell us how he really feels one day. I mean, it's just a shame. If you're just joining us, this is Tell Me More from NPR News. We're having our weekly visit to the barber shop. We're getting a shape up with Jimmy Israel, Arsalan Iftikhar, Ruben Navarrete, and Ken Rudin. Jimmy, I have to ask you about this next topic, because you've written a lot about, you know, men and fatherhood. And so I'm sorry, I have to go there. Former North Carolina Senator John Edwards finally comes clean and does a Maury Povich, announcing he's the father of the baby by his former mistress. Dun, 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 dun.
You are the father, right?
He releases a statement saying, I'll just tell you, it was wrong for me to ever deny she was my daughter, duh.
Right.
I inserted the duh. And hopefully one day when she understands,
I am your father,
she will forgive me. I've been providing financial support for Quinn and have reached an agreement with her mother to continue providing support in the future.
Right,
Ken wrote about this too, but Jimmy, I'm dying to know how you feel about this.
You know what, there is the political angle, but and go with me here for a minute, because the one... if there is an upside to stuff like the Edwards scandal, Levi Johnson's custody battle, and other celebrity baby daddies in the news, that I think if enough of these, clean-cut white guys, when they start having the inevitable friction with the mommies down the road, it may cause a critical examination of fathers' rights issue in this country. Because, you know, single fathers often have to fight for the right to parent their kids. You know, so, I mean,
we don't seem to have that here.
We don't seem to have
We don't seem to have him fighting for the right to parent his.
Not yet.
Child.
I said when and if. I think there might be some friction down the road, because I mean suppose he wants to bring the baby over with him and his wife, or you know, or just there's always baby mama drama. Let me just tell you that as the single dad in the shop, trust me, it's always something. So,
I take your point though, that this is the kind of thing that, you know, minority men are always being tagged with this label of being the irresponsible dad, and it's kind of interesting to see the script flipped here. I mean, Ken, you wrote about the political implications of this for your blog on political junkie, and obviously he's out of politics, he's done.
Yeah, but, did you know that his father worked in the mill all his life?
Oh, I'm sorry.
Here's the thing that just drives me nuts. It's the fact is that here he is. Look, everybody has affairs, and we could talk about the Ensigns and the Sanfords and the Clintons and everything like that.
Everybody doesn't, but
careful, Ken.
I'm sorry. What I meant was this is not unusual in politics, but there's something about John Edwards, the way he rubbed his morality in our faces at all times. The sainted Elizabeth. The fact that here I am, not only running for president, but if I can't get the presidency, I'll offer myself up as vice president. If the National Enquirer didn't break it when they broke it, and John Edwards did get on a ticket, and if they broke it in October of 2008, I mean, President McCain and Vice President Palin would be sailing away right now.
So what's the bottom line here? You think we should do more reporting on these issues?
I don't know. Yeah. That's exactly it. I don't know. I don't know what role the media should play in that.
Ruben, can I just ask you, just because you're the other guy who's written about the dad, you know, the responsibilities of dads a lot. I just want to ask your perspective.
Well, let me see. I mean, just to follow up on Ken's point quickly, the one thing about the saintly John Edwards, he cared more about poor people than the rest of us. You know, he would go down, down to New Orleans, start his campaign there. You'd see him with a hammer building a roof or something, right?
He's in Haiti right now.
Right. I mean, it was always like, you know, I am more moral than you, as evidenced by the fact that I care more about poor folks. The problem is that Edwards had all this money, made all this money in trial as a trial lawyer. He lived in this big, huge house in North Carolina and all this stuff, and didn't really fit the image. Here's the thing that I think about fatherhood, to make Michelle's point. This story tells us there's a lot of things you can do for your kids, and this business about providing, you know, the most offensive thing he said was that, you know, I keep providing for this. I've supported this child, Quinn, all along. I've been giving him money.
Right.
You know, forget that, dude. The fact is you ran away from this baby. And he says so in his statement. He says, one day I hope that the baby's able to forgive me, right? Baby grows up, forgive me. This tells me that no matter what else you do for your kid, we all know that it's more important to spend time than to buy him nice new toys. Whatever else you do, you own up to your responsibilities. You set a good example, right? You teach them values. That's how you become a dad. Not, you know, providing.
I hear you.
I hear you.
Finally, we just have a minute and a half left, and I just, and Jimmy, collect yourself. I know you're going to need a minute. That, you know, the Conan O'Brien is walking away from that program, and I know Arsalan. I don't remember whether you are in tears as well. I see you're kind of dabbing your cheeks here, but what do you think about that?
Well, I'll try to compose myself. You know, I think a $40 to $45 million payout. You know, this whole late night, you know, debacle that we've seen is pretty redunculous, if you ask me. You know, I think that at the end of the day, you know, we're dealing with, you know, almost a double digit unemployment rate. We're dealing with one of the worst recessions that we've ever seen. Now we're, you know, talking about a bunch of, you know, elite comedians who are getting paid tens of millions of dollars.
Oh, man, talk about buzzkill. Come on, man.
Sorry, dude.
It's something to talk about. It's like a boxing match, except there's no blood. Go ahead, Jimmy, what do you think? I know you're trying to compose yourself, and, you know, your grief, I know, is palpable. But.
Well, Conan's getting $32 million, and he's making sure his staff gets $12 million in severance pay to walk away or to be shoved away. And I think it's a sad day, you know, because like I've always contended that Conan is the talent, is probably one of the more talented people that have held that seat right behind Johnny Carson and Jack Parr. And, you know, it is a sad day. But he's going to land on his feet because Conan's one of the most talented cats in this business. So
why do you like him so much?
Again, you know, as I said before, I like him because he's a writer that rose up off the desk to become a talent, and that's not easy. That's not easy in television. That's not easy in Hollywood. You know it, and he's a massive talent, massive talent.
Ruben, he's also the future because he's got such a great appeal for that under 30 crowd. And Leno is very much the baby boomer, you know, comedian. Good for him. And Carson was a World War II comedian in terms of the generation. But you know, Conan certainly is the future. I look forward to a matchup one day, maybe him and Fox someplace else, him against Leno.
Mm.
Leno, I think, is funnier. I got to tell you, I think funnier.
Thank you. Thank you. We're on Team Leno over here, Ken and I. And you. All right, we have to leave it there for now. Ruben Navarrete is a syndicated columnist who writes for CNN.com and San Diego Union-Tribune. He joined us on the line from San Diego. Jimmy Israel is a freelance journalist who writes for TheRoot.com. He's also a presidential fellow at Case Western Reserve University in Cleveland, Ohio. He joined us from WCPN in Cleveland. Arsalan Iftikhar is a civil rights attorney, the founder of TheMuslimGuy.com, and a legal fellow for the Institute for Social Policy and Understanding. And Ken Rudin is NPR's political editor, and they both joined us in our Washington, D.C. studios. Gentlemen, thank you.
Peace.
Yep, yep.
And that's our program for today. Our technical director is Kimberly Jones. Our theme music was composed by Underdog Entertainment, with additional arrangements by Ian Honeyman. I'm Michelle Martin, and you've been listening to Tell Me More from NPR News and the African American Public Radio Consortium. Let's talk more on Monday.